Morning, Your Honors. I'm Jeff Neeson. I'm a CJA-appointed attorney for Mr. Gooch. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time.
All right.
For rebuttal. I know that the court has carefully gone over all the briefing, so what I'm going to try to do is simply emphasize those points which I think are most significant about this case. Obviously, the case that's controlling this is Strickland and the lead cases out of the Ninth Circuit, all of which I believe I have cited. The issue basically is the two-pronged analysis in Strickland, saying first I have to show that there has in fact been activity by this attorney which is not meet the standard. In other words, he was in fact ineffective, and then the second element is prejudice. First, let me address the first prong of this, the ineffectiveness of counsel. First of all, I want to tell you, I know this attorney. He's a fine fellow. This is not what the issue is. The issue is whether or not his actions in this particular case fell below the standard which we would expect of a criminal defense attorney, and I submit that it did. The bottom line of this case is that approximately 2 weeks prior to trial, or within 10 days prior to trial, the attorney knew and had to have known that the critical government witness which was going to put a gun in the hands of the client was in fact Mr. LeBlanc, and that his testimony conflicted directly with the testimony of this Ms. Trout. Now, at that point, if you're going to trial, it seems to me that you're going to have to muster every bit of evidence that you have to challenge Mr. LeBlanc's position, because his testimony is literally all that puts it into the hands of the defendant. Absolutely puts it. It takes it from being just sort of, I was around that area when it occurred, to being in control and having possession of the weapon.
How do you balance that with the fact that this unobtained testimony from Trout would also implicate your client?
It may.
Well, not may, but isn't that sort of the judgment to be made, the judgment the counsel made of damned if you do, damned if you don't, and I make a strategic decision not to go this route?
The problem is, if I relied as defense counsel on all the reports that I got from the government, then I would never have to bother investigating. The whole object of this is to find out and get behind those reports, find out what Trout is really saying. Is she really conflicting? Is she telling the truth? Is she going to be a good witness? That's why you have to conduct that kind of examination. That's why you had to go find Trout to make that decision. It became even more important.
Counsel, if I could ask you a question.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Didn't the counsel have grand jury testimony?
He did.
And did it include testimony of Trout?
It did.
So why does he have to go talk to her to ask her, did she lie in the grand jury? You know, if he looks at what she said in the grand jury and decides that's a double-edged sword, that it might hurt his client, he might be able to use it against LeBlanc, but it might also implicate his client, why can't he do that when he's got grand jury testimony?
As the court is well aware, the testimony for the grand jury is stilted and not subject to cross-examination. All he has is the testimony that was produced, which at that point is unchallenged with respect to truth. We assume that she's testifying in the grand jury, she's being truthful. But until it's tested by cross-examination and scrutiny, you don't know. His only opportunity, if LeBlanc, how do I put this? Once he knew that Trout was not going to be called as a witness and that they were relying solely on LeBlanc's testimony, he had to have known, or should have known, that LeBlanc's testimony conflicts directly at the grand jury level with Trout's testimony. LeBlanc goes through and carefully explains what happened, and Trout talks about the same transaction, and you cannot reconcile the two. Now, what that gives a jury, ultimately, at the trial, is the chance, I guess, to decide whether LeBlanc's telling the truth, whether the child's telling the truth, or whether either of them are telling the truth. But the problem was that the attorney never bothered to interview Trout. He may very well, had he interviewed, I said this in the brief, had he interviewed Trout, and had he gone through whatever he would have done and said to us, you know, I just didn't care for her, I'm not relying on it, that would have been, I think, okay. But he didn't do it. And we believe that there is still, and this comes to the second point, which is prejudice, we believe that Trout's testimony remains inherently unbelievable. Now, the government will argue to you, well, wait a minute, there's a letter she wrote. Well, if you read carefully the letter, the weapon we're talking about in this case is a .25 caliber Beretta. The letter that she supposedly writes, and all of the circumstances under that letter we don't know, talks in terms about a .40 caliber Glock. It's not the same weapon. It's not anything. If you look at the interview that she supposedly gave, which is taped by the government, the interview itself says that she called, well, the reports say that she called Gooch. When you read the interview, you find out that she really didn't call Gooch. It was her friend who called Gooch, and supposedly she was speaking to Gooch.
Okay, but let me just stop here. As I understood the strategy, the defense counsel has to make a decision on what story to shape the case around.
Yes.
So he is a little bit stuck here with what LeBlanc says, and even if LeBlanc isn't in total continuity or congruity with Trout, he's really stuck on where his client is and physically, and is he at the house, and is he a part of this transaction? So he stakes out a position kind of over here, in effect, and says, you know what, we're just going to, like, move my client over here so none of this happened. He can't do that if he has Trout, right?
If you believe anything Trout says. That's why Card becomes important. He didn't interview Card either.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when you scrutinize this record, these are not reliable witnesses. They're not people who tell the truth. And either one of them could tell a story which is untruthful, and either one of them could have been impeached by both sides of this event. But the point of it is, it all is coming in front of the jury. The jury has to decide, based on that evidence, whether or not Mr. Gooch is, in fact, inactively controlled these weapons, or whether or not he's, as he claims, he's just sleeping on a bed, and when the cops came in and you know, he reacted, they found these pistols.
When you, if to come back to the first prong, on the first prong, though, of this, what would you have us cite as authority for your proposition, which I understand is that, and one sees it in the capital cases, the Supreme Court saying that it's ineffective not to interview members of family, witnesses, and so on, particularly in penalty phase aspects, before they make a decision of whether or not a tactical decision, that you have to lay a proper foundation. What's your best case outside the capital context for us to say, as you were eloquently putting it, he could have made the call he made, but he did it without talking to the witness before making it?
I'm not sure I can give you a non-capital case because I'm not familiar enough with all the facts of these things. All I know is the Rioso case that I cite and the cases I cite in the brief. I didn't give you all these string citations. I tried to tell you the cases that I thought were most significant. And I believe the analysis in those cases is absolutely appropriate. That had he interviewed these people, had he made a learned decision that they shouldn't be called, I wouldn't have a chance. But he didn't do it.
Counsel, I'm sure that that's correct in the normal case. But the question is, do you have any precedent that says that counsel has to go forward and interview a witness when counsel has the witness's sworn testimony before a grand jury on the same subject?
I do not have, I cannot cite you a case for that proposition. All I can tell you is that I think, as a practitioner in the field, I would never rest content to simply rely on a grand jury testimony. That's why I hire investigators. That's why we do an independent analysis. That's why we look at the facts. It may be that that is totally correct. It may also be that it's not. And in this particular case, we have grave doubts as to the credibility of Trout, as to the credibility of this entire story, and that's the reason we filed the appeal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tim Ohms, and I'm here from Spokane representing the government in this appeal. The trial counsel in this case, Dan Johnson, provided effective assistance at trial, and he had a rational and reasonable strategy in relation to Elizabeth Trout and her testimony. That strategy had two parts. First, it was to interview her if possible. And the second part of that strategy was not to do anything that would inadvertently bring her into the courtroom or trigger her testifying at trial. What did he have available to him in developing that strategy? Well, he had a report of investigation from the ATF agent. He had a tape-recorded interview with Elizabeth Trout that was transcribed and is part of the record here. And he had the sworn grand jury testimony of Elizabeth Trout, and he also had some corroborating information available to him. One bit of that was the letter alluded to by counsel in which she discusses a transaction with the defendant, a transaction involving a firearm, and that letter was discovered by her boyfriend, Clark Richardson, and that's what opened up the investigation, because once Trout's boyfriend found that letter, he called the ATF agent and said, I think there's more to this. I think my girlfriend's not telling the truth.
If you hear out defense counsel on appeal, what he's really saying is, well, how can you even make all those judgments if you've never even interviewed the witness? I mean, you can create a strategy to try to wall your client off that he just happened to roll in there, and you can do all that, but how can you fall back on a reasoned strategy when you haven't even interviewed a key witness that you've decided not to even deal with?
Well, that's not what he did. He had two parts of the strategy. The first part of the strategy was to interview her if possible. He hired a private investigator. He assigned that investigator to go interview her. And
somewhat inexperienced investigator, is it?
Well, he has a college education. He's a licensed investigator. He had 2 years of experience at that point in time. He worked under the tutelage of his father, who was a more experienced investigator. And the defense hasn't pointed to anything in his investigation that was defective, other than the conclusion that he didn't find Trout, and therefore he must have been an inadequate investigator. That's not the conclusion that the trial court arrived at. It's not the conclusion that the trial attorney, Dan Johnson, arrived at. He was satisfied with the investigator services, who located many witnesses and who actually testified at trial. So also, the investigator, Mr. O'Donnell, continued to investigate up until the time of trial, and he made several efforts to locate Trout. It wasn't simply, you know, one effort to go out and look for her. He couldn't find her and reported that. But there was a continuing effort to locate her. And that's found in excerpts of record 109 and 110. So there's been no showing that that investigator did anything wrong or any specific reference to his conduct or how he proceeded with the investigation to show it was inadequate.
Counsel, if I could ask you a question. That's on the same line as I asked your colleague for the appellant, and that is there any precedent as to whether the duty of a defense lawyer normally to interview witnesses is affected by their having sworn testimony, like the grand jury testimony, in hand on that subject?
I haven't seen a case that says that has that fact pattern. I think that I would point to Your Honor's own opinion in the Galazza case, where
maybe you could point to it specifically because I can't recall all these by name.
Well, that was a case in which a defense attorney, there was an element of a conflict in it as well, but the defense attorney failed to interview a passenger in a car that was involved in a drive-by shooting, and there was some evidence that the passenger may have done the shooting. And in that case, the court held that when, and I'm quoting, when the record clearly shows that the lawyer was well-informed and the defendant fails to state what additional information would be gained by the discovery she or he now claims was necessary, the ineffective assistance claim fails. And so we're looking at the question of how well-informed was the defense attorney. And keep in mind, this was a defense attorney that was trying to interview this witness. He wasn't ignoring that request of his client. It just didn't happen. But he also had this other concern that even if I interview her, I don't see any way that calling her is going to help my case. He was fully informed through that grand jury testimony and through the recorded interview, where he could actually sit and listen to her voice on the recording. And importantly, in this case, the defense has interviewed Ms. Trout since the trial through a defense investigator. That defense investigator didn't point out any difference in the information that she'd provided in her grand jury testimony or in her interview.
Your point there being, even if you were to assume the first prong of Strickland, it doesn't get you over the second prong.
I think that's true, Your Honor. It goes to prejudice, but I think it also goes to the issue of whether or not the trial attorney was fully informed, because in Galazza, the court says that the defendant failed to state what additional information would be gained by the discovery. And in this case, well, we had some additional discovery in preparation for the 2255 petition, and the defense still hasn't said what additional information would have been provided. I mean, really what's at the heart of this is just a disagreement about trial strategy. What's at the heart of this is current counsel suggests that it would have been a better strategy to have thrown this Hail Mary pass of calling her to the stand and...
Well, he's not saying that. That's not what he's saying. Not Hail Mary, call her to the stand. It's the interviewer and then decide whether to make the Hail Mary pass.
Well, I think what my point is, I think that that's really what's at the crux of it, though. Because
I don't think so. I think counsel has said, we can all stand around and speculate about prejudice. The attorney says, I made these judgments, and Reynoso and some of these other cases say that's all very well and good, but it's incumbent upon a defense attorney to go talk to the witness, find out what they know, and I think Judge Gould has honed in on one of the distinguishing characteristics of this case, as you are, but nonetheless, there is a fairly strong jurisprudence that counsel are supposed to go talk to witnesses, and I'm not, you know, whether there was an adequate investigation to try and really track her down, it seemed a little bit half-hearted after a while. But in any event, I think that's the crux of what counsel's certainly arguing today.
Well, I think if the impression is that the investigation was half-hearted, it's because trial counsel was conflicted and did not, and that second part of the strategy, not to do anything that would inadvertently bring her into the courtroom, was in the forefront of his mind. But that's not something that the investigator was burdened with. The investigator was given a task, go find her. And he was unable to do it. And there's been no showing that that was as a result of any specific failure.
How did they find her post trial?
She was in federal custody years later, post-trial. She was actually in a federal penitentiary, and the new investigator hired by the defense found her in that penitentiary and interviewed her over the phone. And again, there was nothing new that was developed. She still said, I talked to the defendant on the phone, and he confirmed that he had the Beretta 25 caliber handgun. So in the end, the defense in this case argues that the defense attorney should have insisted that his investigator find Trout to interview her. And I think all that essentially means is he should have asked for a trial continuance. And the record reflects that he considered that, and he rejected that strategy for good reason. And the trial court, who sat through the trial, heard the witnesses, agreed with that as well, and felt that that would have been a risky strategy. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. You used up your time, but you might want a minute for rebuttal in any event.
Very, very quick. I believe Judge Fischer has eloquently indicated what my argument is. Several quick points. I think the record's clear that once he received the grand jury documents, once he received the list of witnesses, he did not ask the investigator further to go find Trout. He was simply going to accept whatever that result was. And I think...
Well, we have the record, so we'll be able to take care of it.
Second of all, this isn't in the record. I wanted to see if we could find Trout, and we did.
Well, you know what? If it's not in the record, then definitely can't consider
okay.
it.
Okay. Well, the question is, my investigator found Trout. I have not done anything with that other than I wanted to see if we could find her. We could.
Well... we have the record in front of us, and that's the
that's
record.
Fine
that's
fine, too. That's I believe that on this record, this is a razor-thin case, and I believe that on this record that my defendant was entitled to have full representation that for whatever reason it did not occur under these facts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case just argued, United States versus Gooch, is submitted. Thank you for your argument.